Agile Show. I'm your host, Shaheen, and I have Alan Holop, a famous speaker and a very renowned, I would say, software craftsmanship. And I would ask him to introduce himself. But hi, Alan. Thanks for being on the show.
Hi, Shaheen. Happy to be here.
So for myself, for the listeners that they don't know you, will you please tell us who Alan is?
Nobody's ever asked me to do that before. I don't know. I've been doing this for a long time. I've been doing this since dinosaurs ruined the earth. I started out doing hardware design. Right out of school, I was a hardware engineer doing robotics work.
Right.
And in the process of doing that, we were using CPUs that we didn't have compilers for, so I had to learn how to write a compiler. And by the time I got done writing the compiler, then I had to write an operating system because there wasn't an operating system for the machine either. And by the time all the dust settled, I was a software guy instead of a hardware guy. But right. And things have moved on from there. You know, I wrote for Dr. Dobbs for years. I've done a lot of stuff, spoken at a lot of conferences, at least while there were still conferences happening, as we'll see how that goes. I'm scheduled for a bunch of stuff in Europe in the autumn, as we'll see. But things are open or not.
And what is the main theme of the conferences that you, or the main community that you are talking at or speaking at?
Software. In other words, I don't particularly like the notion of Agile being something separate than software. It's all software development that we're talking about.
Right.
And Agile has turned into this horrific thing that doesn't mean anything anymore. The word has become meaningless.
Right.
And so I'm kind of reluctant to position myself as an Agile guy sometimes because the word is such snake oil, is that the Scrum certification people have turned it into garbage.
Right.
So the way that I look at it is we're all just making software, and there are some good ways to do that and there are bad ways to do that. And I can help you make it better. Make better software better, right? I can help you with process and stuff. And of course, I'll draw from real Agile thinking, not the fake stuff, but real Agile thinking and Lean and lots of other things, right? There's lots of moving parts here and lots of pieces that interconnect with each other in order to be able to do things well. So that's, I don't want to limit myself to what Agile has come to mean nowadays.
Right.
So, a lot of the conferences I talk to then are just general software conferences. They're not Agile conferences.
Agile. Yeah, that's awesome. When you were describing about yourself, it reminded me of one of professors or instructors at back in Iran when I was doing my software engineering bachelor. And at that time, you would do 2 years. And after 2 years, you decide between a software specialization or hardware specialization. Mm-hmm. So for the first 2 years, I picked both syllabus. And then at the 2 years, but this professor that I had, he was telling me that it's not about software or hardware. It's about the mindware. So it's all about how your mind can solve the puzzles, right?
Yeah.
And when you were talking about Agile, and it's not the silver bullet, it's about like, how can we make the software in combination of all the other things, make it better?
Well, it's all the same pieces too. You know, you can describe a hardware circuit board as software.
Right.
People do that literally nowadays, right, with PLAs and stuff. But even when it's discrete components, right, is that a servo is a loop. And you can code it up as a loop as you wanted to, or you can implement the loop in hardware, but a loop is a loop. It's got a termination condition. It's got feedback. It does, you know, it does what it does. So the differences are not as large as people think that they are. I think you're right. Yeah.
Right. So let's go back to Agile. Because this is the show called Lean on Agile and Elevate Change. So it's all about, we are leaning on Agile, and you talk about fake Agile and real Agile. So tell us more about the people that are new to Agile, the people that are maybe more time spent with Agile or in the software. Let's not close it off to Agile people. In the software, what are the real Agile, and what can they get from that so that they use it?
If whatever you're doing is called Agile, it probably isn't. We can start there, right? Scrum is not Agile anymore. SAFe is the opposite of Agile. I know a few of the people who were signatories to the original Agile Manifesto, and I talk to them occasionally. And most of the people that I know that are the original Agile people don't want to have anything to do with the word anymore. It's come to mean this horrific thing that has to do with prescribed process and managers telling people what to do and everybody in the organization marching in lockstep, doing the same process and starting their sprints on the same day and just all of this craziness. It's just garbage. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't help you elevate change. It's that Agile is all about agility. Mm-hmm. And if you have a rigid process, you have no agility. So the word has come to mean something not very good. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the original Agile, though, it's really the things that people were doing in the late 90s, which was translated into the Agile Manifesto as best as those guys could do it, right? Those were, of course, just a dozen people. Right. There are lots of people that were deep thinkers in the area that were not at Snowbird. And but they did a pretty good job of putting together sort of general thinking, principles, and values about what it means to build software in an agile, in the English sense, way, in a flexible and nimble way. And I think it still pretty much holds. There's stuff in that document that I think needs to be changed. That's not so much that the document needs to be changed, but we've learned a lot since then.
Right.
Right. So it talks about an iteration being anywhere from a couple of weeks to a couple of months. And I think most of us would laugh at that anymore, as we're talking a couple of hours to a couple of days.
Right.
And they talk about projects. And nowadays, at least in the last 3 or 4 years, we've kind of come to realize that thinking in terms of projects is not a good thing. We need to be thinking in terms of the product as a whole. Right. But generally speaking, it's all pretty, the stuff that's there is pretty good, right? The core stuff is all things like give people the tools and the freedom that they need to work and then let them work. Right. And it all has to do with collaboration and trust and things that don't seem to come up in the context of what they call Agile nowadays. Right. You look at SAFe, and SAFe is the opposite of trust.
Right.
SAFe is this big prescribed process that tells you how to do everything. And it's all heavily controlled. And there's a lot of hierarchy there. And trust is, though, as far as I'm concerned, at the center of doing stuff in an Agile way. Because if you really want to be flexible, if you're really trying to be flexible, right. The people that are doing the software, writing the software, have to be able to make the changes that are necessary right then. Talk to a customer, you find out something needs to change, you change it.
Right.
If you've got to go through some elaborate process, you can't do that and you lose your agility.
Yeah.
So you have this war between traditional waterfall companies who will not give up that thinking. But they say somehow they're agile. They bring in a couple of scrum trainers who are selling their snake oil, and they get a bunch of certificates, and they say, yeah, we're agile now, and they're not, right? Because there's no flexibility, right? My acid test is that if a customer comes along and says, I really desperately need this, can you have it to them in a day or two, right? If you can't, there's no agility.
Would you think that is where we are at is because that Scrum has become the most famous of the Agile frameworks. I don't want to call it framework, methodologies or mindset. Because
it's not a methodology.
Yeah.
Scrum is a framework.
Framework, yeah.
It's just a framework. But really what we're talking about here is the marketing ability of Jeff Sutherland.
Right.
And, you know, when Jeff and Ken split apart into Scrum Inc. and Scrum Org a few years ago, my heart went with Ken. I think Ken really still understands what Agile means, and he still is trying to teach it as best he can. I think Jeff has gone completely off the deep end. To be honest, maybe I shouldn't say that in public, but I think what he's saying now is just crazy stuff. That all that he wants, he posted a tweet a while back saying the reason that the coronavirus is so bad in the United States is because the hospitals aren't doing Scrum. And that is just so repulsive to me. It's so repellent an idea on so many levels that I can't. And I believe that he believes that. Right. And I, you know, if you're at that level, you're talking about religion now. You're not talking about ways to produce better software.
Right.
And he basically wants to sell his product as best he can. So there's all this craziness, like twice the work in half the time. Right. That's just repulsive. That's not what Agile has ever been about.
Right.
Agile has been about getting valuable stuff into your users' hands.
Right.
And in order to do that, you have to have short feedback loops.
Right.
So you have to have speed because you've got to have short feedback loops. But you get the speed by making smaller things, not by doing the speed up the work garbage that you see in the non-agile organizations, right? But Jeff has just like completely gone over to the dark side, and he's saying, no, it's all about half the time, right? And it just turns my stomach. I really don't like it. Right. And the problem is he is selling something that the faux agile, that the dark agile companies want to hear. Mm-hmm. He's saying you don't really have to change the way you think about stuff. You can be agile just by like paying for these expensive classes and getting certificates from us. And the companies that don't really want to make any significant changes buy that, right? Because it fits into their worldview. So Scrum has taken off precisely because it's not agile. Right, the more popular it's gotten, the less agile it's gotten, because he's pandering to the companies that he's selling certificates to, right. And it's a bad feedback loop. I don't like it. I've been trying to avoid the word agile if I can, for reasons like this, is I don't want to be associated with that. Right. It's got nothing to do with actually getting good quality, valuable software into my customers' hands. It's got nothing to do with making my customers happy. It all has to do with surveillance and monitoring and getting people to work harder and stuff that I think is the opposite of what working in an agile way means.
So what would be your approach if a CEO of an organization comes to you and talks about, we want to be more agile or become more flexible in what we do? How would you talk to them? How would you go about that?
What I like to do is I like to sit down with ideally with the C-levels, with somebody who's as high in the organization as I can possibly get. Right. And I want to have a conversation. And Agile, a lot of Agile is about talking. It's about conversations. Right. And I want to say, what's keeping you up at night? What's really worrying you is where are there pieces of the business that you think are dragging the business down, right? And stuff that's just stopping you from being able to function. And those tend to fall into certain kind of well-understood categories. They have to do with, often they have to do with things like not delivering fast enough. But what people really mean by that is that we're not getting stuff that we can sell into our customers' hands fast enough, right? Not not delivery in general, but rather the delivery of value. And those kinds of things are solvable using real agile and lean techniques. Mm-hmm. So rather than bringing up agile, I'm not interested in agile. I'm not really interested in selling agile to somebody. I'm saying, okay, you've got this problem. Okay. Well, here's how we could address that, right? Okay. Let's learn how to make the units of work smaller so we can release more often. Okay. Let's get rid of distractions. Let's limit work in progress so that we have fewer distractions and we can get stuff out the door quicker because we're not distracted by all this other stuff that's not going to bring money into the corporation. It's not going to bring value into the corporation. Okay. And we can address all of those issues without uttering the word agile. It's got nothing to do with process. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with Scrum. It has nothing to do with sprints and backlogs and all that other garbage. It has to do with being flexible and doing stuff in small chunks and taking the customer's word seriously and having feedback loops everywhere. And you know, there's a bunch of stuff that it has to do that are basic principles, but it has nothing to do with following some process by rote. So I talk about their problems then and how we're going to solve them. Right. And I'm an agile guy, which is to say that generally speaking, I believe in doing that incrementally if you can get away with it. Mm-hmm. Right? Mike Rother, I'm sure you're familiar with Rother's improvement kata.
Yeah.
But this idea of, you know, identify where you are and where you want to go and then come up with a bunch of small experiments that you can run iteratively to get from here to there. Right. And that's a good way to do it if you can, is that sometimes you can't, is that incremental changes I find work best in small and medium-sized organizations. The big organizations are so screwed up that if you don't do a big bang, everything at once change, you're going to fail. Mm-hmm. I've never known a large corporation to go agile. Never, never. I have never. Yet. I have two, maybe three times. And in those cases, what happened were that the C-levels came in and they said, we're just going to throw out everything we're doing now and fix it. Mm-hmm. Right. The big use case for that you see is ING Bank in New Zealand. That's the one that was been most recent, right? Where they just said, we're going to do everything. And if that means we have to lay off half of our middle management staff, they're going to go. And they got a lot of pushback from that for obvious reasons, but they did it and they ended up agile on the other side of it. Now, they went through two or three attempts before that failed. So they understood what didn't work at that point. They really kind of had a good understanding of how to make the transition and then that worked for them. But it's possible to do, right? Home Depot did a pretty good job of transitioning over to Agile. It can be done, but the vast majority of companies can't do it. Any company that thinks that SAFe is a good idea will never be Agile.
Right.
So, and if you look at most of the corporations out there, that's the market for the SAFe guys, right? And none of those companies will ever be Agile until you can get C-level leadership in there that says, no, this SAFe stuff is not what we need, and we have to do something else entirely.
So what's your message to the people that are truly believing in Agile and working not at the C-level, but at the ground level? Maybe they are a Scrum Master in large organizations. You are not telling them to be hopeless, right?
Well, I go back and forth. It's, no, I don't think you should be hopeless.
Right.
I have seen situations where you had a small Agile group within a larger group.
Right.
And this small Agile group was really Agile, and they basically built a wall around themselves and wouldn't let anybody come in. Mm-hmm. Sometimes literally. I know in one case, they took over a little corner room in a floor, right? There's probably, five teams. And they took over a room way off on the side of the building, and they literally would not let management in. Not let them come into the space. And they were by far the most effective set of groups in the organization. So management was willing to leave them alone because they were doing such good work. But they were just not, the people who were in charge were very protective of, I wouldn't want to say charge, but the former managers of that group gave up managing, put the management responsibilities onto the teams where they belonged, and their full-time job was to run interference for the teams and keep the rest of the corporation away. And they did a very good job of that, and it worked well.
Right.
So here we had a small Agile organization within a much larger, not at all Agile organization. Right. And that larger, not at all Agile organization was miserable, as they brought in the least qualified, most incompetent Agile consultant I've ever seen, who was working directly from the CTO, and she was wreaking havoc everywhere.
Right.
But this one group was doing pretty well. So that's certainly possible. Once that happens in some organizations, the people who are around that group say, well, what are those guys doing?
Right.
They're all happy. They come into work with a smile on their face. They're doing great work. They're pushing management away so they don't have to deal with any of the garbage that we have to push away, that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Right. And they start paying attention. And gradually that small group can grow. It can infuse out to the rest of the organization as a whole. So it's possible. It takes a long time is the downside. Right. So a corporation who is saying, okay, we're a big company and we want to be Agile in 5 years, you can't do that starting with little small things and gradually infusing out. It's just not enough time to do that. Right. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't.
So some companies have taken the Agile units and split them off into separate companies, left them alone. Mm-hmm. That works. You know, you look at some, well, W.L. Gore, of course, is famous for following Dunbar's numbers. When any organizational unit gets larger than 150, 200 people, that they split it off to another company entirely. And that works really well for them. But the giant corporations that are determined to not change anything are never going to be Agile. I think that really is hopeless.
Right.
You know, if you have a big corporation that says, okay, we're going to put the PMO in charge of making this Agile, and that's a doomed effort to start off with. I know that's going to fail. So you can do little Agile stuff.
Right.
Right. And you can do some things that'll make your life easier. You can pair program and do mobbing and things that just sort of make work better,
right,
make it so that you can be more effective.
Right.
But you're going to be pushing back against the rest of the organization all the time.
Right.
So in Scrum, if you're doing Scrum right, one of the jobs of the SM, and I think probably the most important job of the SM, is to push back against the organization, is to protect the team.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have somebody, whether they call themselves a manager or a Scrum Master or whatever, but somebody who's willing to make it a full-time job to protect the team from the rest of the organization, well, then the team can be Agile.
Right.
But even then, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to get to be able to talk to your customers directly. It's going to be hard to get the feedback you need. It's going to be hard to deploy often enough to get valid feedback.
Right.
There's going to be a bunch of obstacles in the way that are going to have to somehow be addressed.
Right.
And it's exhausting is all. You're wasting a lot of time and effort and energy doing stuff that you should be spending writing code rather than pushing back against some evil organization, right? So, you know, some organizations, some are salvageable. Some of them are not. If it's not, the best choice is probably to just walk away if you can.
Yeah.
Hard to do in the current plague environment, but it is possible sometimes somewhere.
Yeah. The famous quote, change your organization or change your organization.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I hate to say that because it sounds so pessimistic, but
yeah,
you know, there are people that have been following me on Twitter for a while and they work in these horrible places and they talk about it all the time and they're just kind of stuck there and it's a miserable life. And so it's not a life that I would like to lead, at least. So if you can't go to work with a smile on your face, you shouldn't be going, you should find someplace else to work.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's just not worth it.
Maybe it would be challenging at these times because we are in uncharted times, but we find ways if you are want to find happiness, I believe.
Yeah, but don't try and be agile.
Right.
Don't find happiness by trying to be agile. Learn about agile and learn about lean and try and be happy by taking some of the basic principles and practices and stuff and incorporating them into your work. So right. Don't even think about agile. Just think about, well, if we could get rid of some of this work in progress, you don't even have to say the words work in progress, right?
Yeah,
but if we can get rid of some of this WIP, then our lives will be easier, right? Because we won't have all these distractions and stuff. It'll be more fun at work, right? If I'm pair programming or doing mob programming, it's more fun. I can get more work done faster. And I can do it in a way where the work is better and I'm just generally happy. So don't think about, I'm going to be agile. Think about what can I do to make myself happier in this environment and do that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, if it's agile, if it's lean, if it's design thinking, whatever that is.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah,
it doesn't matter.
None of that matters. Those labels are just, at this point, those labels are a problem, not a help. And I wouldn't worry about the labels.
Yeah. Yourself are very close to the code as well. You're not one of those coaches that are not close to the code.
I program all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So I was watching you talking about agile architecture for I believe it was 2 hours on YouTube in a software conference. And what I really liked, it was a principle that you named after yourself. Sorry if I pronounce your last name.
Principle. Yes, my replacement principle.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. This is if you want to be agile, because we talk about lots of agile things at the collaboration level, at the process level, but this is the core to the technical level. And I read that the whole of replacement principle is you should be able to radically change a class without affecting any of the objects that use that class.
Use the class, right? I would say that it goes beyond classes, right? Any any unit, right?
So a class, unit,
or service, or a module, whatever. It's a recursive principle.
Yeah,
it goes down to the class level, but it goes out to the service level.
So tell us more about that. Like, how would you go and introduce that for the teams and or the organizations? And
the Agile is all about being able to make changes quickly, right? In other words, there's a necessary change and you want to get it into your users' hands as fast as you can. And if you are in a world where if you make a small change over here, it impacts 15 different things elsewhere in the program, right? And in the case of a big, badly done spaghetti code monolith, you can make a small change in one quarter and it can affect thousands of lines of code scattered all over the monolith. It takes months to find them. And in that kind of world, it's not possible to be agile because you can't make a change fast enough. It's not that you can't make a change fast enough, but then you have to waste a huge amount of time making sure that you haven't broken anything. So you make a small, reasonable change, and then you have to waste 4 months proving to yourself that nothing's broken before you can release. And that's prevents you from being agile. So the idea of the replacement principle is that if you can replace an implementation without affecting the clients, what that means is that the thing that you're working on doesn't have any dependency relationships with the clients.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In other words, there are no clients that are making any assumptions about how the way that the thing that you're working on right now works under the covers.
Right.
So if none of the things that are using you know how you work, then you can change the way that you work and they won't be affected. So, you know, there's lots of ways to pull that off. If you're talking about something at the class level, for example, that what that says is that the interface in the general sense to the class doesn't change, at least doesn't change much, but the implementation of the interface could change radically and nobody cares. Yeah. So, but that has ramifications too, because then you've got to start designing interfaces in such a way that they can hide implementation that way.
Right.
So if your interface is full of get and set functions, for example, you're hosed, because all those get and set functions are accessing fields inside the class. And that means that you can't ever get rid of those fields or change their types or anything, because all the getters and setters will break, and that'll break all the clients. So you've got to start, that forces you to start thinking about not how objects do things, but what they do, right? And you start thinking about every module recursively through the system in terms of what does it have to do? What does it do? And at that point, you're not thinking about implementation anymore. You're thinking about activities. You're saying, I need this other thing to do this for me.
Right.
Go do the work and then come back to me when you're done, right? And the it's the same amount of code as you had before, but it's going to be organized very differently. But what that gives you then is once all the dust settles, you're in a position where you can start making changes locally, and the effect of that change doesn't ripple out of the local area. Mm-hmm. So you can focus on one thing, make the change, and have, you know that you haven't broken anything, which means that you can now be agile. Because you need to make a small change in order to keep a customer happy, and you go, you make a change and you're done. And you don't have to worry about anything else. So it's all architecture and process and code and culture. They're all connected.
Connected. So let's talk about that. I wanted to get our conversation to this point and maybe talk about a little about meta on this one. Would you think that someone as a coach that goes into an organization and want to change them into a more agile way of doing can do that without understanding these kind of concepts?
You have to, it's all connected.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the ways that agile has gone wrong is that people have defined agile as a process. Mm-hmm. And it's not. Right, is that the people have come to think, well, if I have a backlog and a scrum master and a PO and yada, 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 I'm agile. And that's not true.
Right.
Because if you're fighting your code, you can't be agile in the English sense of the word. Right. You can't be flexible and adaptable and graceful and all of these other things that the word agile means if it takes a month to make a change to a small piece of code. So. One of the biggest mistakes I think organizations make when they, quote, transition to agile is they imagine that they can live with their existing horrific big ball of mud monolith and still be agile. And that's probably not, right? Probably the code is going to drag you back and prevent you from being able to make changes fast enough. Right. So it's everything is connected to everything else. There's no, you know, and it goes even beyond the you know, things like soft things like culture and stuff. It goes to the physical workplace. Even if we were working remote, it goes to the physical working equipment, right? Both of us, I notice, are set up so that we can look directly at each other as we're speaking.
Right.
And that's important, right? But how many times have you like tried to have a meeting with somebody remotely and they're like looking like this, right? And it means you can't connect, right? And you can't communicate at a proper level. And we have, since we do this a lot, right? We've all got good equipment. We've got good microphones and we can hear each other clearly and that kind of stuff. And it makes this conversation possible. And if we were fighting that equipment, we couldn't have a conversation. And if we couldn't have the conversation and we had been talking, the conversation was about code, we couldn't make the code go easier either, right? So it impacts everything. It affects the physical environment as much as it impacts things like culture and process and that kind of stuff.
It reminds me of a talk that I believe Dave gave, one of the Agile signatories gave that talk at GoTo conference. I believe it's 2015. It says Agile is dead. And he's talking about the first thing he's talking about is that people are calling this Agile Manifesto. But if you look at it, it's Manifesto for Agile software development. So in the title, even if it's software, but people forget that software piece, they focus on other pieces. Let's change the culture. Let's change the process, right?
Yeah, but and again, then, I think it's all connected again.
It's all connected. Right?
You can't do the software unless you've got a culture that supports it. Right. So there's kind of a movement on Twitter, at least, about people that are pushing back against this notion of Agile has anything to do with software. Mm-hmm. It's like, if it's not explicitly called out in the manifesto, it's got nothing to do with Agile. And I don't buy that. It's that it seems to me that the goal here is agility.
Right.
And anything that touches that is relevant. And there are lots of things that touch that. And culture is certainly one of them.
Right. Right?
Process is one of them. Tools are one of them. There's a lot of stuff that affects that. And the goal is agility, though. The goal is to be able to get valuable stuff into our customers' hands as fast as we can. If we can't do that, we failed. So whatever we have to touch to make that work, we have to touch, be it culture or tools or whatever. So I do think it is a software in the sense that I hear a lot of, you know, we used Agile to make cars or something like that. And I more power to them, but I don't know how to do that. I don't know what that means. You know, right? As my expertise is entirely in software. I don't know how you could take any of this and apply it to anything else, really. Is the, you know, lean, right? You look at lean, there's a lot of lean that we borrow from manufacturing, but we're not running factories, right? There's a lot of lean that has no relevance to software development at all because we're not running factories, right? And even things like a Kanban board, right? A Kanban board assumes a factory. It assumes a linear flow of materials from workstation to workstation. And that's not the way software development works.
Yeah.
So those things, you know, that's handy. It gives us valuable ways to think about stuff. But if we're really going to adapt it to software, we can't just pull it into our world. We have to adapt it to our world. You know, and lean itself, right? A big thing with lean, there's one of Tom and Mary Popendick's books. It's the first one. I can't remember the title off the top of my head. The one about
lean software development.
Yeah. She has a chapter in there where she's talking. There's a story about the NUMMI plant in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's a lean software development.
From where I lived, while it was still working. Yeah. And what happened there, though, it was a joint effort with General Motors. And the Toyota guys came in and they set up this very lean environment. It was very successful. And then they, being guides from Detroit, documented it down to the letter. And they took this big stack of documents back to Detroit. And they said, do this. And it failed completely, right? Did not work in Detroit. The lesson here is that what they needed to take to Detroit were the principles and the values that the people in Fremont were using to develop processes that worked for them.
True.
Right. And nobody else could use those processes. Processes, they only work for the people that develop. Mm. So Scrum probably worked just fine for Ken Schwaber's original Scrum team. I have no argument, no disbelief about that. Whether you can then take that process and move it to another team, that I'm really doubtful about.
Right.
And what you can move are the values and the principles. And more, the people who I respect, who are teaching Scrum, people like Ryan Ripley, are saying that. Here are the values, here are the principles. How does what we do fit with the principles of Scrum? And the values of Scrum, and I'm absolutely behind that. I would agree with that completely, because that's much more important than things like, you know, backlog, how the backlog is organized, and story points, and all this other kind of stuff. How does it fit with the values? And then develop your own process.
I think I was listening to a podcast with Ken that he was talking about how they come up with the sprint planning, a sprint retrospective, and all that. And he was telling the story that they looked at the calendar of the teams that he was working with, and they were trying to find out what the purpose of each is, and they merge it so that it fits that team's purpose. And that's how they come up with those. So back to you, your point, to the principles of what Agile and Scrum supposed to be, think about what are the ceremonies or events that you want to have, not just blindly follow.
Right. Blindly follow some process, right? Right. Looking at if you look at the original paper, right? Nanaka's new product development game, right?
Yeah.
Which needs some hyphens. And it's not actually new product. It's the new product development game, right? But they're talking about working collaboratively. They're talking about tight feedback loops. They're talking about important stuff, but they're not talking about a specific process. At no point did they say, here's a process that you should follow in order to be successful, right? They're talking about principles and values. And I think that's important. It's a great paper, by the way. If anybody hasn't read it, they should.
Yeah, highly recommend it. That's fine. Yeah. I recently saw a tweet from you, if I remember correctly. So let me say it this way. So typically when I work with teams, we talk about quality is not one person's role. It's everyone's role, and they might call people QAs. I typically call them testers, but it's everyone's role. I saw a tweet from you recently. It was something like this: architecture is not a role, it's an art.
Well, what I said is that it's not a role, it's a skill.
It's a skill. It's an
art too. I wouldn't disagree with you, though. Right. I think it's an art too. But it's a skill. Yeah, it's not a role, though, right? Anybody can be an architect.
Right.
And I've been having a back and forth with Simon Brown, that same thread. Right? This just last week. And the Simon is sort of more of a, well, you know, architecture is a hard job and not everybody can do it. And, you know, there are certain people that are very skilled at it and other people that aren't. And the role of an architect is a role. Right. And I understand where he's coming from, but I think we actually disagree about this. Because from my point of view, everybody is doing architecture. Every time you write a line of code, you're also doing architecture. Right. So the question then becomes, how good is the architecture? Not whether or not you're doing it. You're doing it willy-nilly, right? But right. the less you know, the lower the quality of the architecture is going to be. So we all must learn about architecture because it's so intimately tied into the code that we're writing. And if we're writing in an agile way, we don't have time to go to some grand architect somewhere and get permission to make changes. We just have to make them. Right. So if we make the wrong changes and mess things up, everybody suffers. And so we can't do that. So the only practical solution to that is for everybody to develop architectural skills. And that still doesn't mean that everybody's going to have the same level of skills, as you solve that problem by working as a team. Right. And I'm a huge fan of things like mob programming. I'm a huge fan of collaborative working. And if I you know, it's been a while since I was a CTO for a company, but it's been a while now, 8-10 years. But if I were to do a CTO thing again, I would have everybody mob programming from day one. And I would build the teams around a culture of mobbing and basically wouldn't hire anybody who wasn't interested in doing it. And the reason for that is that a team working together as a team collaboratively can always do better work than a single person can. So if you talk about a mob of six people, in which one of them is really an excellent architect and one of them is a really mediocre one and everybody else is in the middle somewhere, the group together is going to come up with a good architecture. Right. And if you talk about taking a team of six and splitting them up into six individuals, each of which goes off into their little corner and types away and they talk to each other once a day in a daily scrum or a stand up, you're going to have lousy architecture because you won't be talking to people and getting help and coming up with collaborative solutions. So from my point of view, for Agile to really work, there is that word again, you have to be working collaboratively. And one of the things that disturbs me about all of the remote stuff that's been going on in the last couple of months is that in some companies, it is pushing people to work as individuals isolated from everybody else, talking once a day to the other people on the quote team, but it's not really a team anymore. Right. But if you work by yourself all day and you only talk to other people once a day, that's not a team anymore. I don't know what that is, but it's not a team. And it doesn't have to work that way. I just did a workshop for a client and we spent 4 days doing mob programming and test-driven development. And it was, we were doing it on Zoom and we were using Miro. I think it was Miro. It was either Miro or Mural as a shared whiteboard. And everybody had their own development environment, but we were doing a Git push pull to change drivers. And it was working fine, right? As everybody was working as a team, as the driver switch was taking a little longer than I was expecting one to have happen. Right. There were glitches here and there, but it was nothing serious. And so here we have a remote team that really is working as a team, right? They were literally talking to each other and working together as a team, and that worked great, right? It's not like remote has anything inherently bad with it. Right. But if you don't have a culture that encourages that kind of collaboration, then the remote working pushes people in the wrong direction. It pushes them away. It pushes them towards working alone rather than working together. And that would be very unfortunate if that becomes a stronger tendency than it already has been with people working co-located in offices.
It's a challenge. Hopefully we all get over.
Yeah. You know, we're going to have to learn how to do it. I think there's been a lot of people guessing about what things are going to be like moving forward. Twitter just announced the other day that they're going to let everybody be 100% remote forever. I don't know how that's going to work. No, practically speaking, what I find is that you've got to get together physically once or twice a week to work optimally. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with flexible schedules and that kind of stuff, but you have to have physical conversations occasionally in order to do the best work. And I think we're probably going to end up somewhere in the middle like that, where people will be able to work remotely more so than before.
Yeah, and it's not a typical work remotely, because in Canada, right, you can't send your child to the daycare or like to the school. Everything is closed, right? It's not working remotely independently. You're working remotely with your family in the house. So that adds to the complexity of...
It does. It adds to the complexity only if you define work as something that is in that humans don't do, right? I think work is a human activity, and if what that means is that our kids and our dogs are around, well, fine. I don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, people. Right. I don't want to seem negative, but here you've got your background behind you, your Zoom background behind you, right? And that's fine here because you've got a podcast and you're trying to brand it. And that's a good use of that. Right. But a lot of people are putting like that ridiculous Zoom beach behind themselves when they're talking and that kind of stuff. And that I see that as nothing but kind of a weird distraction, as I would much rather just see whatever room they're in. Right. And they think that there's this. It's not being professional if you can see the space that I'm actually working in. I'm not being professional if you can see my kids run behind me, or my dog comes up, or my cat jumps in my lap. And it seems to me that that's the height of being professional, because being professional is being a human being.
And, no, I completely agree. Yeah, I completely agree with you. But in cases that you need to pay attention to your kid, for example, and you need to leave, for example, then it's going to add more complexity.
That's a good reason to do mob programming. Right. One of the things
about
mob programming is the mob always moves forward, even if an individual has to drop out for a few minutes and then come back in. Yeah. Right? So if you're mob programming and everybody's working at home with their kids and stuff, well, if you need to take a few minutes off to deal with a kid having a breakdown in the other room, well, just do it, right? It's not a problem. The mob will continue to make the work move forward.
Right. It's actually a very good selling point in these times for mob programming.
I think so. At least if you do it right, right? It's like people who object to mob programming think you're somehow chained to your desk and you're or handcuffed to the people in the mob. And it doesn't work that way, right? The point is that the mob does work. And the mob's composition, though, is changing dynamically over time, depending on what people need to do. And if you need to take care of a kid, that's fine. If you need to look something up on Google, that's fine too, right? Whatever you need to do is you go do it. But meanwhile, work is continuing to move forward. So I think, as you say, it fits really nicely into the current situation. Right. I wish more work. You know, it works so well, and it's so much fun. That I had become something of an evangelist for it without really intending to be, just because I'm really kind of excited about it as a way of working, and it's a great way to work. And the people that object to it, there's kind of two classes of people. There's the kind of people that don't really know how it works, so they can't imagine it, right? They think how could it be effective for five people to sit around and watch somebody work, when in fact it's really five people working and one person taking notes. It's a different different dynamic to that. And they pick it up almost immediately. Is that if I sit down and do a workshop where we just do it, right? I find that you can't teach mob programming and test-driven development by giving a lecture. Do it, right? So when I do TDD workshops and when I do mob programming workshops, we just sit down and do it. It goes slowly at first, and then it gets faster and faster and faster. And I'd like to take a week. A week of half days works fine. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to the end of the week, everybody knows what they're doing. And at that point, most of the people that are doing it, they don't want to do anything else, really. But then there are a few people in the profession that joined the profession because they are kind of antisocial. I don't want to use that word really. It's not a good word, but they don't really like working with other people. They want to work by themselves. Mm-hmm. They don't feel comfortable working with other people. And that's why they went into programming. Mm-hmm. And I have some sympathy for that. They can't work in mobs though, right? Because it's going to be too uncomfortable for them. So any company that's doing mob programming also has to figure out some way to leverage the people that can't work in the mobs. So there has to, you know, and there's always plenty of work to do. Unfortunately, sometimes it's seen as low value work. So somebody who wants to work alone, they can be put onto fixing bugs forever. There's usually an infinite supply of bugs that need fixing. But for some reason, people see that as low value work. It's not. It's the most important work you can do is to get the bugs fixed. But they see it as a kind of a demotion to be set to work fixing bugs. But but the nature of the profession is changing. True. And software development it's moving away from this notion of the isolated individual, right? Is put them in an office and throw meat under the door. Mm-hmm. And it's turning into a social, collective, collaborative enterprise. And that's going to leave some people behind. And I have some sympathy for them, but it's life, right? As things evolve. But I think it's better. I certainly, having worked in both kinds of worlds, I I like mobbing and things like that way better than I liked working alone by myself. And I'm an introvert, right? So I don't buy the argument, oh, I'm an introvert, I can't mob programming. I'm a hardcore introvert. So I love mob programming.
It was eye-opening for me when I did it myself.
Yeah, it's always eye-opening. But you have to do it, right?
Yeah, you have to do it.
You have to do it.
You can't lecture people on TDD or these things. They have to do it. Like when I was doing some liftoffs for teams, I added when they were coming from the break, I was doing a little bit of TDD, like what is the next test we do? And there were people from the business side. I'm like, why are we coding? Like we don't supposed to be. And I was telling them that the product that you're putting out there is a software. And after 2 days that we did that, they came and say, oh, now we know more about what we are putting out. It's better for them to understand that. So
yeah, well, that's part of it. The other part of it, they don't even have to go down to that level though.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Because after a week or two, you'll be putting out better quality stuff than you were doing before at equal or better speed.
Right.
So if you have like a non-technical person, then that's all that they see. Right. Right, more output. Right. They'll be happy, right? They don't really care how you go about doing it. They might be dubious, but you know, if you're only talking about a couple of weeks to try it out, there's not much to lose in trying.
Right.
So you might as well try it, and the results are pretty immediate and pretty impressive usually.
Right. So we are kind of coming to an end, Alan. Mm-hmm. If you have to leave our audience with one thing that you want to tell them, advice, something that you want to share with them, what would that be?
You know, I guess the main thing now is that more and more, the whole notion of agile and stuff doesn't mean much to me. Is that what's important to me is working together with other human beings in order to produce the best stuff that I can. Mm-hmm. That I can use agile and lean in other techniques to do that, but the issue is to do what the Agile Manifesto says and to focus on the people, mm-hmm. and not on the process and not on the tools and not on all this other stuff, but just focus on the people and thinking, okay, as a bunch of people, how can we work together best to get stuff done, to produce high quality stuff and to have a good time while we're doing it. If you're not smiling while you're working, then you gotta find something else to do for a living. Mm-hmm. So if your focus isn't that, then I guess my advice is to try and make your focus that, is to focus more on working with people and collaborating and doing things like that, and forget about the process stuff. It's not that important.
Exactly. I was talking to another speaker on the show. He was telling us it doesn't matter if you're doing agile or not, and how to figure if you're doing agile. If you're not doing agile, you know that. You don't need to go around about it.
Well, the test is simple, right? Customer comes up and says, God, I hate this. Or they come up and say, I really need this. Right. And you say, hold on. And then you go, here it is. Right. And they go, yeah, that's what I want. Right? Then you're agile. That's what agile is. Right? Right. Yeah. However you can pull that off, you're agile. Right? That's fine.
So before ending up, I have one last question for you, Alan. Mm-hmm. So is there anyone that inspired you in the past? Is there anyone that you want to name them or refer to them for the people to follow and learn from, other than yourself, obviously?
You know, the people that I learned the most from were people that you have never heard of. They're people who mentored me when I was just starting out programming, for example. People that I learned from at work who just kind of taught me how to do what I'm doing as a human being and be good at it and stuff. They are sort of this vast mass of unheralded mentors that make everybody who they are. And, you know, there's a lot of people who I've read through the ages and in some cases gotten to know, who I think very highly of, who've helped me a lot, like people like Jerry Weinberg, for example. That of course they were instrumental in sort of changing the way I think and teaching me things that I didn't know before. But in terms of just being who I am and being really good at what I do, that's more an attitude thing, I think, than a specific knowledge thing.
Okay.
And the people that are important to me are the people that I've worked with who were willing to take the time and sit down with a green kid who didn't know what the hell he was doing and be patient with him and kind of really teach him how to do the work, how to program. Mm. And if it wasn't for people like that, I don't think I could be doing what I am doing now. So those are the people that I value most, through the mentors that I've had through the ages.
Okay.
So if you're not doing that for kids who are working for you, do it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's probably the most important thing that you can do is mentor people, is help them.
And be patient with that.
And be patient and teach them the stuff that's not in the books, right? The stuff that they need in order to actually get the work done.
Right. Awesome. Again, thank you, Alan, for being on the show. Is there anything else that we want to, before saying goodbye?
I can't think of anything on hand. I've talked about a lot. Sometimes I think I talk too much, but anyway, it was fun. So you're welcome.
So we put your contact information for people to get in touch with you on the show notes. If you need anything to put there, please.
Just my email, my Twitter, right, is I'm at Alan Holub, and I'm alan@holub.com. So that's relatively easy. Mm-hmm. And my DM is open on Twitter, so feel free to get in touch with me. And I'm also on LinkedIn, but I don't check my LinkedIn email that much. So Twitter or email is the best way to get me.
Okay.
And of course, if I can be like totally self-serving for a moment, I'd like everybody else nowadays could do some work. So if you want me to come in and do a workshop for you or just talk to you about what it means to be agile and maybe help your organization move ahead, give me a call and we can set something up and have a chat.
Thank you again so much for being on the show, Alan.
You're welcome. My pleasure.